On this week's show, accounting for the advantage in construction with Chris Lee from CrewCost. In this week's news, are large acquisitions the future of construction? And more.
Construction is the world's oldest industry, but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, Chris, it's nice to be in charge over here, so I just decided today you and I would sit down by ourselves and have a conversation, because you have a pretty good story and a pretty good history, so thanks for sitting down with me today, man.
Jeff, my pleasure, man. I've been waiting to catch up with you and see how things are going.
We've been touching base since the day you let me hang out in one of your offices where you were working and record a podcast and a webinar with some incredible job sites behind me. And, you know, we hung out and talked a lot about your history. So I'm excited to dive in.
Let's do it, man. You know, I think those job sites, they actually finally capped that off. You know, they're going through about a floor a week for about a year or so. And I think they finally capped the building off a few months back.
Yeah, I think they did. So if you guys want to check that out, there was an AI webinar back in the day with Chris Lingiza, me, Josh Levy, and Trent Miskelly from Document Crunch live from the offices with it was a lot of fun, actually. So that was a good day. But listen, I don't know. I know not everybody listening knows you. So let's talk about a little bit about your history. You have a pretty cool path in history that really made me want to sit down with you today, and we'll get you to all the way to where you are today. But where did you get your start in this crazy world of construction?
Probably like a lot of folks, I didn't start out necessarily in construction. I actually started out in management information systems, worked there through my 20s, but I worked very closely with the construction industry. You know, throughout my career, we're building out hotels, hospitals, and we're putting in the network infrastructure. And so when I got into my 30s, I've always been very entrepreneurial. I'd worked with a lot of, you know, low voltage contractors, Division 27, 28, and got the crazy idea that I was going to go start a contracting business. And through a lot of good luck, you know, I happened to be in Austin, Texas at the time. And if you recall, you know, 2012, 2013, we're coming out of the recession. And Austin was just a firecracker. I mean, there were cranes up on every corner. As a person who was working more on the ownership side and hiring contractors, we just couldn't find any contractors to do the work we needed. I was like, wow, there's an opportunity here. And so I knew just enough about the industry to go start a business. I knew people to hire. And I went and started a Division 27, 28 commercial low voltage contracting business. And spent about 7 or 8 years doing that before I sold that business.
That's like Nashville now, you know. It was Austin back then. It's like Nashville now. But it's interesting to start on that Division 27, 28, the low voltage side of things. It doesn't get enough exposure as to how important it is in the process of building. And I mean, I think the amount of scope that's grown in that area is huge.
Yeah, no, it really is. I mean, when you think about the overall project, it's not a big percentage point when compared to mechanical, plumbing, electrical, but it's critical, and it's getting more critical by the day. And you know, you just can't get the job done without it. You can't move into a building without that sort of infrastructure in place. And so, you know, for me, just having an IT background and knowing enough about it, that was kind of my entry point. And, you know, we went and built a pretty neat company, you know, worked with a lot of the big general contractors here in town. I worked on, you know, Yeti coolers, a lot of the Facebook, Amazon projects. We're lucky to get involved in a lot of that. And so considering that, like, I was a fairly young contracting business, you know, I felt pretty fortunate to get to work on those sort of projects.
And this is what I like about your background is, you know, it came from information systems, so you had a pretty good knowledge of it, but, you know, you just had a tertiary knowledge of the industry itself, but you're a true entrepreneur. You got involved and then you got neck deep in running the business. So, I mean, who did your estimating?
You're looking at them, you know, and I know that you're probably thinking like, well, how the heck did you do that? And so, you know, honestly, it was a lot of trial and error. It was a lot of studying. I mean, I read every estimating book I could get my hands on. I read every project management book I could get my hands on. And that's where I started. And what I, you know, stumbled my way through that, did very small projects in the beginning. But what I did think I did do a good job of is going out and networking and meeting folks in the industry that had a lot of really good experience and bring those people to the team. And so once I went and hired estimators, I went and hired project managers that knew a lot more about the industry than I did. And I basically just soaked up everything I could from them.
It's an awesome model because it's undersold that somebody can not be the expert and can go get the experts, but still be in the leadership role, can still run the company, right? There's so much more that goes on. So it's sort of what attracted me to where you're at now is how you keep approaching building. So what happened with that company? And then, you know, where did that take you next?
2 or 3 years into building that company, one of the things that just kept bubbling up, you know, this was 2013, 2014. And if you remember at the time, technology just was, it's not what it is today in construction. And so I was printing out paper plans. I was going to Kinko's 6 times a week, spreadsheets, driving around to job sites to physically verify that, you know, there was an issue in the field. You didn't have things like Procore and PlanGrid. You did. They just weren't as commonplace as they are today. And so one of the things that just really was a problem for me was estimating. I mean, we did a lot of lower value, high transaction, high volume of projects. And so I just found myself printing plans every week, and I couldn't believe that there was not any sort of like good product for that. I mean, there was decent products, but they're all on-prem. They're crusty looking, you know, 1980s built products, you know, and again, a lot of them were really good. Like one of, you know, I always joke with people that had I discovered Bluebeam, I would have never, you know, went and created my next company. And so long story short, I ended up creating a cloud-based takeoff and estimating application. And we built that out of just pure necessity. That's kind of what started the project. And then we realized, you know, as we were building it, like, wow, this could be commercially viable product that could benefit other folks. And so we built a product called Esticom, worked on that for 3 or 4 years. And at that point, I decided to move my attention full on to the construction technology product and actually sold my contracting business to some of the guys that were running the business at the time in my absence, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're split between two things. In the beginning, it's a necessary evil because you don't have it. And yeah. You know, we've seen a lot of these software companies come out of construction companies over time out of necessity. Like you said, they couldn't find what they needed. You know, it's funny because that's 2013, 2014. That's right when I joined the industry. That was the year where I thought maybe this wouldn't be for me. And then thankfully to people like you and the Procores of the world and Bluebeams and others, I thought, wait, there's hope. You know, maybe there's hope. And so I stuck around and now I'm, you know, I am one of the industry, I guess I have to say that now. But it's cool because what usually ends up happening is those founders, they try to keep splitting time for too long. So you really decided which one was for you and you went down the route and made the decision. I'm sure it wasn't easy to leave it, but you know, it in the long run, it seems to have been the right decision. So tell me a little bit about making that decision and then, you know, really diving in both feet at Esticom in, you know, say 2014, 2015, because that's a crazy time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, on one hand, I had a business that was thriving, that was doing really well, that was paying the bills, and it was actually paying for it. You know, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I actually bootstrapped Esticom. Like we never raised money. We didn't go out and get venture capitalists to give us a bunch of money to go set it on fire. We actually decided intentionally we wanted to bootstrap this thing. And so it was kind of nice because I had this contracting business. I was actually able to use it almost as like a testing ground, right? So like we'd build a new feature. I would have my team that was estimating projects actually go test it out and make sure that what we were building was working. And then they were constantly giving me feedback. And then so as we got the product to market, you know, we'd already had it in front of, you know, construction contractors for a year or two at this point. Like, it was really solid. It worked really well. And so there was very quick adoption to it. It wasn't this, you know, kind of typical MVP path that you see a lot of folks take. You know, we had a fully fleshed out product by the time we really got to market with it. And so as customers started signing up and going to it, it was still kind of a losing proposition of money wise, right? It wasn't making money like the contracting business. So it was tough to be like, hey, I'm going to move my attention off of what the golden goose over here, what's paying the bills and paying for this. I'm going to go focus on that. But, you know, luckily I had some really good management and leadership within the contracting business. They stepped up to the plate. They were able to keep the business running, not only running, but growing while I was focusing on Esticom. And then they actually approached me about buying the company, and they ended up buying the company, building it up even further. I think they doubled it in size in a year or two. And then they got bought by a company, a really big company out of Canada. And then that company actually got bought by Bosch, which is a big, big $70 billion company. So kind of interesting story. You know, some of the guys that just worked for me bought the company, built it up, and then they made a really good outlay, or a really good exit, I should say, just a year or so later. And then I was off, you know, 100% focused on Esticom at that point.
Yeah, I mean, so awesome, because we don't tell the entrepreneurial story and the wins enough. And yeah, if you're focused and can start something from the ground up and kind of hold on, you can really, you know, win and make money. And that's, I mean, in the end, that's kind of what we're here for. I know in construction, we hate to talk about the fact that any of us are here to make money. You know, we're all supposed to be here because we love the industry. Guess what? We love the industry, but we need fuel, and cash is fuel. Money's king. That's so right. Talk a little bit about, so you moved on to Esticom. You're 100% involved, and Esticom has a really cool story as to where it went.
Yeah. So, at this point, I think it was 2019 or so. We probably had 1,500, 2,000 customers. We had a really good customer base. We're adding functionality, really getting our stride with the market. And, I was thinking that I was going to be on this path for another like 5 to 10 years of just continually improving the product, continually going out and chasing additional market share. And Procore came knocking. You know, we were partners with Procore at the time. We had had a lot of success on their app marketplace with an integration that we had built, and it became an interest for them for their pre-construction strategy to have a takeoff and estimating application that was very, very tightly integrated into the rest of their platform. And so, we chatted and talked over, you know, a pretty extended amount of time, probably a year or so. Year, maybe a year and a half. And keep in mind, at this time, this was 2020. So I think COVID had kind of happened. So that came in. People were a little bit unsure of what was going to happen in the industry. We weren't sure, like, you know, wow, is construction, is it going to be as busy, or we're going to see like a big shutdown? We never really saw that. You know, I actually saw our business actually increase significantly, signups increase significantly. I think one of the things that really was advantageous for us is that when COVID happened, the cloud became much more important because people couldn't work from the office. So if you're using one of these older products that was like on-prem and you no longer can't connect to the server, or you can't collaborate with your coworkers, cloud became much more important. And so that really helped our business. And, again, being in the right place at the right time, I feel like I got lucky there more than anything, but that helped out quite a bit. And then we ended up getting acquired by Procore. And I spent from 2020 until, you know, about this time last year at Procore, about 3 years.
You hit it there. It, luck is part, things have to fall your way, but it's also about positioning. It's also about timing. It's also about modern, so you were a cloud application, which was the right architecture at the right time. And kind of a catastrophic event for the world turned into a necessity. And so, as much as it was lucky, it was good positioning and it was good forethought and it was good building of something, at some point in that process, you could have decided, hey, I'm just going to build a better you know, what do they say? Build a better mousetrap and keep it on-prem because I want to use it. But, you know, I think it's kind of cool because we have this in common. Your information systems background and cloud background opened your eyes a lot earlier to where this all was going and the need for this and the need for the way it was going to change. So you spent some time at Procore. You went from, and I think this is unique to tell this story too, about 2019, 2020 is about when I got involved in pre-construction. Okay. Because I had been in construction and, you know, me, just like you, I'm always looking for, you know, what's the next big area of improvement and growth and evolution in the industry. And with the rise of, you know, the labor shortage, new means and methods, you know, fabrication, offsite, the complicated mechanical and electrical systems that we're dealing with now, it was pushing for a need to plan better. Right. And to change the way we did pre-con, right? Pre-con became, it went from counting to planning and scheduling and coordinating and making decisions and all of that. So again, great timing for a tool that's integrated into a platform like Procore, because no one ring to rule them all. And I think it's interesting, you know, there's a lot of people who've gone onto the app marketplace over time and found, you know, with this Procore at the center, found new products. So you went inside. So you went from the outside to the inside. What was the inside like? What'd you learn in there? What maybe surprised you along the way that made that such a beneficial part?
You always hear these horror stories of people being acquired and you go somewhere and you get your baby ripped out of your hands and they just dissect it. And you know, the old Silicon Valley where they put you up on a roof and lock you up there. And I mean, my experience was the exact opposite of that. I mean, you know, Procore was, you know, they really, what they preach and what they talk about and culture and really believing in the industry. Like at first there's so much of it, you almost don't believe it. And I got there and I'm like, okay, like these guys really eat their own dog food. They believe this. And they really do, like they live it every day. And so my experience at Procore was awesome. I mean, I've got lifelong friends from there. You know, the technology itself, the vision of the company. I mean, I learned so much working at Procore for the last, you know, well, not the last 3 years, but for that 3 year period, just about how to build culture within a company, how to set a vision for product, how to address technical challenges like in the right way. You know, it was just a great time in my life and I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. It's really cool to call this out, 'cause there is a lot of fear. If I've even seen this on RFPs recently from companies, like, do you plan to get acquired? And mm-hmm. I'm like, well, if you listen to Chris's story, Chris didn't plan to get acquired, but Chris is a business person and they approached him with an offer you can't refuse. But it's really important to understand the difference between we bought you, we got your client list, now get in your hole and leave us alone, to we believe in what you're doing, we believe in the path, but we also believe that you should be inside of this bigger thing because we're going to build more onto it. Because if you look at what Procore did in that 3 years after acquiring you, is they've built an entire suite out for pre-construction that's farther probably than you guys could have envisioned wanting to tackle.
We could have never done that. And, you know, that's the cool part. You hit the nail on the head. You know, some companies, it's why are they buying you, right? And if a company is buying you just for your list of customers, or they're buying you because they're a PE firm and you're just going to go off in a corner and they're going to rake the cash in until you get sunsetted, that's just a different thing. With Procore, you know, there was a real strategic reason for buying us. They wanted to connect the different processes. And as a company, we wanted to do that, right? Like, it's the next logical thing. If you're estimating and you're doing pre-construction and you're planning, the next logical thing is like, okay, where's the next value add in the process? It's like, okay, how do I improve the handoff to the folks that are going to do construction? How do we streamline creating purchase orders? How do we streamline buyout? How do we get contracts set up? That's the next process. And it would have been impossible from where we were at to go build that. And it would have taken, and Procore had a lot of that, it would have taken them 5-10 years to go build what we had spent 5 years building at that point. And so it really was, there was a lot of just really good synergies there that made sense. And we were able to move forward at a much faster rate. And the amount of value that it provided was just, it was amazing on day one. We would, I would take customers that were Esticom customers that then became Procore Financials and Drawings customers, and they would estimate a job. They would get all their pricing in there, and they'd click a button, and the drawings would move over to the construction drawing tool. The financials, the budget would be set up with all the cost codes and everything that would normally just take days or weeks to go set all this up. You would have purchase orders set up and ready to go. And at that point, now you're just approving, okay, is this purchase order? Can I go buy these materials? Can I go do these things? So just like really streamline that process. And then, ultimately what the vision was for this was that you would eventually come full circle, right? So if you think of like over here, we're estimating, now we're doing, construction, we're capturing costs. So we have estimated costs over here. Now we're doing the work, we're capturing costs. We're measuring and seeing how the estimate versus the actuals look. And then eventually that data flows back down here into some sort of database, this cost database. And now we're updating it and we're providing real-time insights when you estimate your next job. And so, again, for me, that's the holy grail of construction. And that's really for a construction company, that's the value of the construction company is how much do you know about being able to go build something? How much is it going to cost? How long is it going to take? And when you connect all those workflows, that makes that easy. And that's something that we never could have done on our own. And, Procore would have gotten there. They had a big head start, but it still would have taken them, they'd still probably be working on that right now, or they would have acquired somebody else. So for me as an innovator and as someone that's, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want the credit having gone and built and solved something. I just wanted to see the industry go forward because I had the pain of being that person. And so I just wanted to see that happen. And sort of the quickest path for that to happen was, I was all for it. And so, I thought it was really cool to see that happen.
Whenever you're talking about something as substantial as suicide awareness and as alarming as to statistics around construction being the second highest rates of suicide in industry, we'd be fooling ourselves if we thought that this was a one-player fix, meaning that it just takes one silver bullet or one easy button to solve this challenge. This is a multi-threaded challenge, if you will, and it's really something that is the responsibility of all of us to lean in, to raise awareness, to provide tools and resources, to up-level conversations we have around, in construction, we're pretty much, hey, what's my job require me to get it done at any cost? Well, we now see what the outcome of that is. So I think it's important that we partner together to really have a unified voice around why mental health awareness is important, why it matters, and how we can frankly do better as an industry. It takes each of us leaning in to really create that.
And you are at your heart an entrepreneur, and you are at your heart into this industry because you just kept getting closer and closer and closer to it. And so you did your time at Procore, and I think, did a great job of handing it over, and it's cool to see where it's going. But you had a new itch that you had to scratch. And I want to get into that because you and I really connected on this one, just given both our history. So talk to me about what you saw and, what you're up to now, because you got some new stuff coming.
Yeah, for sure. So, I'm not even sure where to start on this, but I guess where the itch came from originally, when I was running my business originally, my contracting business, there was kind of two big problems, really three big problems I always ran into: estimating and takeoff, the project management side of the house, like making sure, jobs were running as we're wanting them to, scheduling, things like that, on the operation side, and then the back office accounting and financial management. Like that was always a really, really big pain point for me. And there just wasn't a lot of good solutions out there. So at the time when I'm looking at these things I could go build and what are my real pain points, estimating takeoff was something I felt like we could go swallow, we could go build, and we can go after immediately. I wasn't too intimidated by it. And then project management at the time, you had some really good players already attacking this. Procore was already on it. They're already doing a really good job. But that third one was accounting. in construction financial management. Like I could never find the tools that I needed as a small business contractor to like really understand how my individual projects were impacting my overall company financials. You know, it was always, I'd look at my P&L and it's like, I don't know how I got to that. You know, I didn't really know if I was making money. And the problem is there's just so much data from all these projects. It's just hard to like bring it together in a way that's digestible that you can then go make decisions with. And so fast forward through building an estimating application, working at Procore, I just kept hearing this over and over and over again. I think I always assumed that like as companies got bigger, there was options available to them. And I get to Procore and I'm working with these companies, not big companies, but I worked in kind of their emerging space, which is, call it like, 50 million and below. And these guys are still using generic accounting applications, QuickBooks, Xero, things like that. And they're literally, trying to fit a square peg in a round hole to make these things work. And so that leads me to where I'm at now. Over the last year, I've, I put together a team and we worked really hard to build a modern, easy to use, affordable construction accounting software that's for the SMB space, right? So something that's the right size for contractors that are, let's call it sub $100 million in revenue, sub $50 million in revenue.
So people are going to go, well, wait, accounting, it's not that special. What's so different about construction accounting versus, regular accounting? And it's like, until you're in our space, you don't know. So to maybe some of the construction techs that are listening, or just to make a few of those accounting folks that do listen to us feel a little better, why is it so different? Why are we so hard? Because there are tons of companies out there running on, these other platforms.
Construction accounting is just different. It really is. I mean, there's fundamental aspects of it that are the same. I mean, you follow some of the same GAAP accounting principles. Your P&L looks the same, but it's just not the same. The revenue recognition is completely different. It's project based, so in a typical accounting software, you don't have a way of breaking a project out as a profit center that has its own profit and loss. And so I'd say that's probably the biggest difference is that component. It needs to be project based. You need to be able to stand a project up, create cost codes, cost types, be able to track a budget and get to the end of the project and say, hey, this is how we did from a P&L perspective, versus it just showing up as costs on your company's P&L. You need to be able to dissect it and understand how that impacts it. The other components that are really, really difficult are in construction, because there's most contracts are long term, right? They're several months, they're years, and you're building something in a dynamic environment. You're at a job site building something that's never been built before, and so you can't just charge that person and say, hey, give me this amount of money for this house I'm building for you. You have to build it with a progressively percentage of complete, which is what people use today. And these other accounting softwares that are generic, they don't have a concept of that. They don't have a way of recognizing revenue based on the percentage of the project that was completed in that particular month. And if you don't have that, you don't have a way of accurately showing what your profit and loss is. And so that's another big piece. The third big one, and this is I actually underestimated this quite a bit because I wasn't a general contractor, but retainage was an absolute nightmare to track. And for me as a subcontractor, I only had to keep up with the upstream retainage that the GC owed me. But I didn't have any way of doing that. Like all I could do was short bill. Like if I was billing you $10,000, you apply $1,000 retainage, all I could do is bill you $9,000 and my P&L would be off, right? There wasn't a way of recognizing that 10%. Well, when you're in an industry where 10% net profits is like, that's pretty dang good. Like 10% retainage is disappearing. It completely throws your P&L off. Now, if you take that and you look at like a general contractor, or you look at like a big sub that has tier two subcontractors, now they've got to track downstream retainage as well over months and months and months that a project might exist. How do you do that, right? There's not an easy way of doing that. You got to have systems in place to be able to do that. And so those are, I'd say those are the three big things: project-based, being able to recognize revenue based on the percentage of completion, and retainage tracking, you know, are some of the big things that are going to be key pieces.
It's really awesome, because that you did a great job of just explaining the differences and the uniqueness of this industry and why it's not served as well as it could be by technology. And because, again, we're a specific market, right? A lot of other companies, a lot of other products can be altered to make it into here. But, you know, if you look at a retailer, a rental, or, you know, all these point of sale systems, they're, you know, realizing what they're doing, and they've got, you know, pretty much follow the same rules, and we just don't follow those rules. So it is important that we are, you know, in some respects, I hate to tell construction that they're unique, and in many respects, you are unique. So this is one of our most unique areas. And in my opinion, it's super underserved. I mean, are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right, we're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more. Money is not why we're in construction, but it is the fuel for our ability to operate businesses, to be profitable, and to know where these problems are. If you're talking about a $50 to $100 million contractor, one project can cost you. One project can kill you. It can sink you.
It's our business.
And yeah, and if you're not paying attention, and I know, I just sat down with some of my old colleagues for a lunch, and the one guy said, I was throwing some ideas out at him. He goes, "Well, man, listen, I think this is great, but like most of the small ones we're dealing with, they're putting $3 to $5 million out. And as long as they're getting 3.2 to 5.2 back, profit is what it is." And I'm like, that is so risky. And they're like, "Yeah, but that's the biz we're in, man." And I'm blown away by that. I guess we have a risk tolerance for this that we shouldn't have, right? We should be more profitable. We should have our eyes on the prize more.
You would think, considering how cash intensive it is, and what you have to do to the amount of risk you take on, you would think that like the profit would, you know, account for that, right? Like any other industry, like the more risk, the more reward. But it's tough, man. It's a competitive business, and just unfortunately, there's always one person in the room that's going to bid a job down into the dirt, and you know, I don't want to say you hope that person goes out of business, but there's always one that's willing to like really get skinny on a job, and it causes everyone's, you know, profit to kind of erode. The other thing too is, from what I found at least, construction is like if you think about like a typical industry like manufacturing, right? You know, they build a widget. They're going to reproduce that widget over and over and over again. It's pretty easy to figure out like, what are my costs? What are my time? You know, I can control all the variables, like, you know, the manufacturing line. You know, I can't control whether someone's going to be sick or something like that. But for the most part, I can control a lot of variables that impact productivity and the production of that product. And with construction, you can't. It's dynamic. Every project's different. You have different materials, different costs, a different workforce. And so even if you do estimate a project profitably and you think you're going to get there, there's just so many things that can go wrong, you know, from the start to the end of it, that could really eat into profits. And like you mentioned, when you're talking single digit profitability, it doesn't take much to just wasted a year or two of your time, you know, building a project out that you broke even on, right?
Yeah. And it's also an interesting time for it because, you know, money used to be cheap, and money is not cheap anymore. And I mean, fingers crossed, it's going to get a little cheaper here in a not too distant future, but you know, it is an election year. I don't care which side you're on. It's an election year, man. You can't really bank on anything in an election year. So it's now is more than ever. When I talk to small contractors, they are spending leaders like you, if you were back in your contracting days, you'd be spending more and more of your time monitoring your cash flow. And so is there an opportunity with the modern system to monitor that cash flow, to really be more on top of it with less time?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things we run into, we talk to hundreds of contractors over the last, you know, year or so. And one of the, you know, it's kind of interesting, like they associate profitability with cash, right? Like I'm probably funding my projects out of the profitability. So just making sure your projects are profitable, that cash flow from that carries over is what's going to fund future projects. But the other component is the way construction bills, like it's complicated. You can't just like jump in QuickBooks and throw together an invoice and send it to somebody. Like you've got AI payment applications. You've got to show what your percent completes were for all the different tasks that line up to some schedule of values. Like it's very difficult to like aggregate all those costs, create the payment applications that you need to then submit to the GC or for the GC to submit to the owner to be able to get it improved. And one of the things that happens a lot is that contractors, they'll underbill projects, they'll underbill where they're at, or they'll miss. I mean, we used to miss billing deadlines all the time. And it was like, and with construction, as you know, especially on the sub side, it's like 80 days is the average outstanding accounts receivables, right? But you're paying people in 20 days or 30 days. So there's this huge gap between when you get paid and when you're paying folks. And so someone's got to fund that gap in between there. And the more you can close those and the more you can have visibility of that, to better. So one of the things we do is we really put a focus on billings on the job, and we automatically are calculating, like as costs are coming in, we're calculating what those percent completes are so that when you go to bill, it's not a big scramble at the end of the month to go figure that out. It just kind of, it's there, right? And then, and so we're making sure we're not missing those billing deadlines. And then it's just a matter of like making sure you've got a good WIP report and you're not funding too much of the project by underbilling. And that's really key.
Well, you're hitting on two major ones: the end of the month fire drill, which if you've ever worked at a contractor, you know what the end of the month looks like. It is not a pretty place. There's lots of coffee pots rolling and lots of lights on and late and usually some colorful language flying around as we try to get things done. And you're right. In a lot of respects, trades are financing the jobs. And if they miss that billing time or something's not right, they're hanging on it. I was at CFMA years ago, and I think the number was 70% of all trade contractors that go out of business, that go bankrupt, are profitable at the time they go bankrupt. It is a cash flow issue. And I know a lot of the distributors are, you know, leaning in and financing these things. And there's a lot of, you know, new tools popping up to help with that process. But it's like, listen, at the core of it, bill and get those fire drills out of the way. And you really nailed it, you know, with all the things it takes to get those percent completes and get those things out, and the AIA forms and the ways in which we've created a number of hurdles. We make it easy to bill people, right?
Yeah, man, I'd love to talk more about that point you just brought up. I think you hit the nail on the head. Like as a contractor myself and the contractors we speak to, the only time I ever got in trouble financially was when I got over my skis and won too many projects. Sometimes success can be the biggest, you know, but I didn't have a way of measuring that. I was probably also a little too naive in the financial department and overestimated my abilities. But, you know, where people get into trouble is when they get out and their backlog gets too big and they've just got too much work out there. It's not, you know, and again, I haven't been around during a recession in the construction industry. I'm sure it's a different ball game when you can't find work. But for the last, you know, since 2010, at least in Austin where we're at, it's been a very busy market to be in. And the folks that are getting in trouble are just overextending themselves. They're not understanding how big their backlog is. They don't know what all they have in progress, and they're just not billing fast enough, and they're financing too much of the work. And that gets them into trouble.
Well, that is awesome, because you just hit, you know, pretty much throughout the show, all the major areas that, you know, we're concerned about for what I think is the most important group of contractors. The other thing out there is you consistently keep saying between 50 and 100 million, which is the majority of contractors in our country. Majority of the contractors that exist today are that size. And these cash flow problems are really center to their world, and they've been struggling. I've watched numbers of those fire drills. I've talked to a lot of those contractors that experience these problems and are looking for a better way. So it's really cool to see that this is the kind of, you heard it, you knew it, you felt it, but you know, you solved some other problems first and now you're onto this one. Where can people go find out a little bit more and find a little bit more about what you're up to and how they might get involved?
Yeah. Yeah. So you can check us out at crewcost.com. That's the name of the company, Crewcost. And we have a 30-day free trial. You can get on there. You can try the product out and kick the tires on it without, you know, see value out of it before you ever even spend a penny on it.
That's awesome. I love that model as well. We both think the same way, that freemium model, that get yourself onboarded and get rolling and figure it out. So Chris, thank you so much for sitting down today. I wish we had a little bit more time, but it's time to get into the construction technology news of the week. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. In fact, I was so sold on Join that I joined the team as its industry evangelist. Many trade shows and podcasts later, Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built. And y'all know that news comes in twos. So Nathan Wood has joined us for the second half of the interview to really bring the news and bring the noise as he usually does. Welcome to the show, Nathan. How you doing, buddy?
Oh, talk about just-in-time delivery, right?
Hey, you know, sometimes, you know, timing is everything. It's summertime. We all got ups and we've got downs.
Yeah, we got some stuff to do here. Yeah, let's get into this.
So let's roll into it, brother. What do you got for us, man?
I got a couple of fun ones. So, I mean, we've been talking about this whole acquisition and private equity and all this stuff. I saw this come across the ticker. Quanta Services climbed 7% on $1.5 billion Cupertino Electric acquisition. So I think probably a lot of folks may know Kelly Lubeli or are certainly familiar with Cupertino. They're a huge electrical firm doing a lot of stuff in the data center, in the modular, other space. So my first inclination when I read this was, oh, it's another private equity firm acquisition thing. It turns out in looking at Quanta Services, they are, I believe, out of Canada. They are a more infrastructure, but a kind of larger construction and including electrical. So it is really just an acquisition, which, mm-hmm. you know, now makes me think, Jeff, about our conversations of, the large software companies buying the smaller guys. And like, when has that ever, you know, resulted in a good thing? So not to foreshadow any of this or to put any bad ill. It's just interesting to see all the kind of business dynamics going on in this industry and just to see what the ripple effects are going to be on innovation. And I don't know, Jeff, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm two-pronged because I'm actually pro-acquisition in many ways because strategically it makes sense, and we've seen it over the years and we've seen it work really, really well for certain organizations. So again, I have, you know, we've know folks at Cupertino. I don't know anybody at Quanta, but I would never assume I know what their leadership, who, you know, runs giant corporations, is really thinking. But ultimately, I think it's bringing a scale and a serviceability and sort of a diversity for the business organization to be ready for where things are going to go and grow. And, you know, we all know Cupertino is not only a large company, but very specialized and very good at what they do. And so that provides a higher level service to, rather than compete with, weaponize for Quanta over time. So that's my like business impact. I think it's awesome. And I honestly think we like it or not, you're going to see more of this as the need for diversification and elasticity is needed in the industry itself for all of the projects and all of the things we have to do. And having, you know, people at leadership level that have the business sense, but then having people in the field that have the actual track record to deliver on construction is huge. But then my brain can't not go to that. I'm sure those two have very different systems in place and communication platforms and choices, not just because there's no vanilla in any world, really. So now I'm thinking like, wow, how does all of that come together? So, Chris, I'm interested because, you know, we talked about this at the beginning of the show. You know, you started as a contractor that then you sold that contractor to employees of yours, but then they did get rolled up. So this isn't some new thing. So I'm interested in how you see this and how you see this affecting the market.
Yeah, no, that is interesting. That's an interesting play to me because, you know, Quanta is a big infrastructure player. They do a lot of big horizontal construction and, you know, that's really hot right now. You would think they would like double down on that because that's where a lot of the money in construction is going, is to building out infrastructure. And then you think about the other hot thing in construction right now, and it's building data centers for all the AI craze. And so, you know, I don't know. It sounds like that's an interesting play. I mean,
let me ask you a question about that, Chris, because you know about this and you know, you came from low voltage. Does this have a lot to do or even a tip towards smart infrastructure? You know, the blending of the capabilities of a Cupertino in I want to call it, you know, information management and from the plumbing perspective of data and connectivity. Does that have something to do with it? You think maybe there's this maybe Quanta's looking forward and saying, hey, we're going to need that?
Well, you know, I'd be speculating, but you know, you've been hearing about these smart cities and these smart things for the last 15, 20 years. I mean, I remember back in the day, like all the big Cisco system stuffs was all these pictures of cities where you're walking around and the bus stop can like talk to you and things like that and tell you what's happening next. And so maybe that stuff's finally coming to fruition. But, you know, yeah, I think it's interesting that it, you know, you don't normally see big infrastructure players buying more commercial, you know, Cupertino, they do a lot of data centers. They also just do a lot of commercial build out. And I think they've changed focus recently because of how hot the AI hand is now and how much data centers are going up. So yeah, it's an interesting play to me. And it may be that's kind of finally converging, which would be really neat, right?
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
What a great segue into my next one. Cause AI again is the hot topic, right? And someone that I came along the way, learned about, Tristan Harris, is the co-founder for the Center for Humane Technology. You may have watched The Social Dilemma, I think on Netflix. And he just came out with another video called The AI Dilemma. But I think there is so much to this. We're so obsessed with what we can do and what is possible that we don't always really think about the repercussions and the unintended consequences of this. And he's sort of making this larger call as someone coming from Silicon Valley, from the Facebook world, and seeing, you know, how the sausage is made, saying, guys, we got to pump the brakes here. And I think there's some really real, as someone who is not typically one to say pump the brakes on anything, he makes some really, really good points that I agree with. And so if you have not heard of Tristan Harris, if you're not familiar with Center for Humane Technology, I mean, a lot of everything that Construction Progress Coalition is built around is based on what he's been doing for this larger kind of what is our understanding of the role that technology and digital is going to play in the future of humanity, just, you know, with more of a construction lens. So he's just such an awesome person. I encourage you to learn more about him, and hopefully he rubs off on you.
Yeah. Jeff? So I like this one because Chris and I were actually having this conversation in the green room beforehand about how I honestly think, like Chris was expressing how he's a little scared about, you know, the fact that there's so much of our voices out there now that, you know, can be utilized using AI technology to make it look like we're saying things we're not saying. And, you know, totally true. We need people like Tristan out there, you know, doing the best to be ethical, to think ethically, to somewhat pump the brakes. But honestly, here's where somebody out there in the world, and please don't let my 16-year-old listen to this, because I'm going to say something that I don't say to him when he's driving, but sometimes the best defense is a really good offense. So if I see a problem on the highway, sometimes I might shoot ahead to get ahead of it because I see the thing happening behind me if I get away from it. This is where I think the people generating technology and using AI to find AI generated content can actually be such a good offense to create defense. And I think it can trickle past just the AI generated content around, you know, like all of a sudden Chris bad mouthing like all sorts of people, but it wasn't him because somebody did it, to impacting the stream of false information that is completely being generated by bad actors across the world, to, you know, destabilize what honestly is pretty strange. Social media is a pretty strange thing. This internet thing, this super global connectivity is strange, and it's very hard to trust it. So I think there's an opportunity here to put defense to offense. So Chris, I'm interested because we were having that conversation beforehand.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's I'm a technologist at heart. I love some of the things that we're able to do with it, but you know, there's some things that AI that just scare the heck out of me. We're talking about like our parents getting older and getting tricked into things. And, you know, I gotta tell my parents like, hey, you didn't, you know, there's not really a Nigerian prince, and don't send him. I don't even want to know what the world's going to be like where there's a version of me that's calling them and saying, hey, give me your credit card so I can, you know, go pay your electric bill for you or something like that. Like, that scares me.
Yeah. And I like your point, Jeff, about offense versus defense and like cybersecurity, right? Like everything I've learned is like, yeah, like we lean too much on trying to play defense when it's like, actually the right answer is to play a little bit of offense, or that kind of that white hat hacker on yourself. Like the only way to know where your vulnerabilities are is to test yourself and not just, you know, have that overconfidence.
Well, and that is a nice segue. We're going on segue world today because a lot of you will remember back to today. It's the day we recorded it. Usually I don't let people know the day we record things, but today is what we will call the great CrowdStrike outage. So Microsoft CrowdStrike outage hits airports, banks, and hospitals, causing an IT nightmare. So, I mean, I can't wait for some of the statistics. I feel for everybody out there traveling right now or trying to work right now that has critical things. So, you know, hospitals, flights, those kinds of things is dangerous. You know, if you're just getting the day off because, well, your system's not working and you can't log in and, well, great, it's Friday, enjoy yourself, then good on you. But this is critical. And it's interesting because it is a cybersecurity company. And that's what CrowdStrike does. And a lot of the Fortune 500 companies, a lot of large companies across the world rely on them. And this, their vulnerability, their issue, their outage has caused outages everywhere else. So I'm going to draw this back to, you know, construction and construction technology. And it's about understanding the ecosystem, understanding your tolerances, and, you know, knowing the plumbing of what you're using and how you're using it. So it's interesting. I mean, Chris, did it impact you at all?
No. You know, luckily, I don't think we're big enough to use CrowdStrike. So
we're not doing that. Well,
Nathan, yeah, go ahead, Chris.
No, I was going to say it is interesting, though. I mean, is this just a legit outage for them and there's a service outage across these different things? Or is it an under, you know, I don't know if you guys remember years back, but there was another provider like this. And you know, hackers actually use it as a mechanism for getting into a lot of systems and getting data and causing disruption. So they actually went after the security and the IT management company to kind of almost Trojan horse into some of these companies that were using it. Is it something like this, or is this just a bona fide outage?
Right? Well,
there's a service outage.
I'm going to pause on that answer. Nathan, I want your thoughts, but I think it's TBD, Chris.
Okay.
I think it's I do see attack. I mean, it is an attack. So it is something malicious. It's not just, you know, something that went wrong.
Well, is it an attack, or everything I've read says they released an update?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Outage. I'm looking at your different article. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So
outage.
It's just a whoopsie.
Yeah. It's a whoopsie. Yeah. And the unintended consequences of these whoopsies. I mean, we never have whoopsies in construction, do we?
I guess we got to have a little grace, huh?
Here. We got our respect for perspective, my friend. Yeah. Respect for perspective.
Well, I'm interested. I'm going to throw it out there. If the CrowdStrike thing taught you anything, and gave you any positive thoughts or positive things to think about that you'd like, and you're screaming at your windshield right now, or you're saying, Jeff, shut up, let it stay down, because I want to be off on Monday. I want a 4-day weekend. then give us a ring, give us a holler, let us know. Because I am going to segue again. This is 4 segues in a row. This is great.
We're keeping
my
up.
Coverage is about a new technique that could be in play here, Chris. To come back to you, I think it's TBD until the real postmortem is done on this, because I had planned before this happened to talk about this, but there is a thing out there that's being used right now called a registration bomb email attack. And it's being used as a diversion to distract victims from financial fraud. So basically what is happening is a hacker is getting involved and is about to trigger financial information being lost. So you're a contractor, you've been working with a subcontractor, a trade contractor, you're about to release a payment app, you're going back and forth on the bill, and all of a sudden, hey, I need this right now, I got to get my folks paid, here's the information you needed, let's go, let's get this going. They jump in the middle, get false ACH information to you, create a sense of urgency, and get you to transfer the money. Now, they know you're going to report back to that trade that you've gone ahead and done the transaction. So, to give the bank time to make the transfer permanent, they click an automation button and start signing you up for every dang subscription website on the planet.
Oh, no.
And it fills your inbox like a smokescreen.
Yeah.
To divert you from what's going on. And this tactic is being redeployed because of the AI tools that we have today for automation by much less sophisticated people. And so you're going to see it more and more. And I just wanted to draw your eye to it, that if something like that happens to you, you have to deal with the problem, but you also should start looking for any loss of financial information, anything that looks strange. If it looks strange, call the person.
Or just find out. Just freeze all your accounts. By default, just lock everything up and then go figure out what happened.
And if someone asks you to do something outside of your normal routine, it's worth picking up the phone and making a phone call.
But there's even examples where people talk on the phone and get people to wire money, right? Like, even that isn't necessarily a safeguard.
That is true. But I believe if you call the person you're talking to that you know straight from your phone.
Oh, that you know. Yes.
That you know. That's what I mean. That you know. And have the and they'll go, wait a minute. But it goes back to, and Chris,
unless you're the AI voice recognition that can make you sound like that person. Ooh.
It could go pretty far, but I'm going to guess your phone number wasn't taken over by them as well and rerouted. So that's why in the, Chris, you said this earlier about, working with your parents on it. That's why when the credit card company calls you, you don't talk to them.
Yeah.
You turn your credit card over, you hang up, you turn your credit card over and you call the number on the back of it. And you talk to those folks, because if they were them, they're going to know, oh, yes, so-and-so, we know that was you. Thank you for going securely. Here's the things that we're seeing. So, Chris, I'm interested because you've seen this over the years with your, IT background and kind of understanding it, that how do you feel about this attack and maybe just how this falls in line with others?
Well, I've got two thoughts. My first thought is I hope my wife doesn't find this, because I feel like our Amazon bill would go through the roof. She'll figure out how to email bomb me, and she'll go buy everything under the sun, and I won't see the little note.
I mean, Prime Day was like 2 days ago.
So that's my first thought, is I hope she's not listening in and she doesn't go look up one of these little automation.
I love it.
There's your scare for the day, right, Nathan?
Yeah. So you had a second thought, Chris?
Yeah. No, I mean, my second thought is just, as you guys know, in construction, it's very cost intensive. Contractors, they get thousands of emails a month with bills from vendors, legitimate vendors. And it'd be, this could impact them. And anyone that's ever worked in construction, there's always these stories of them getting hacked like this in some form where they think they're either paying an electrician and they're paying someone completely different via ACH fraud. And then you also have a lot of internal fraud where someone internally will pay their husband and there's so many bills coming in that the owner of the company just never even knows it happens. I mean, I think it definitely could happen in the construction world for sure.
I agree. And I think that's why a multitude of things, but having automated systems that watch for those things that control you, whether that be your accounting software or also when you set up and you work in a large project, identifying the payment process, the payment apps, using tools that have the security and the process built into it that are harder to change and harder to alter are key. So, hey, Nathan, any last thoughts?
I just came up with one thing. If you guys know any movie producers, because we need to make a movie that is Catch Me If You Can meets Mission Impossible. So it's like the storyline of Catch Me If You Can, but you know, it's set in the old days, right? So it's like all the ways that they're doing the same thing with like new age technology and AI and facial, you know, distortion things. Yeah, that would be a badass movie.
It really would. That. But
it would educate the audience about this very real thing, right? Because that's what movies do. They're a reflection of society at the end of the day, as off the wall as they are.
Yeah. And here's an interesting thing that you hit there that I don't know if you know you hit on, but this is a human problem, right? It has been a human vulnerability. It will always be a human vulnerability. We will always be building tools to try to help protect us. But ultimately, it's on us because we have vulnerabilities because of the fact that we are human, and that's what makes us special, but also makes us vulnerable. So really think through it. And these things aren't going to change. They're just going to evolve. And with that, I got to say, thanks, Chris, for joining us today, sitting down, talking about crew costs, talking about your history, and then joining us for the news, man. It was great to have you.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nathan, thanks for jumping in just enough, just in time, bringing some really good news, man. It was great to see you.
Oh, man. Always good to catch up on a Friday.
Thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Chris Lee. To read all our news stories, learn about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontechcrew.com. This is the Contech Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.